This podcast is brought to you by Kaya FM in partnership with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation.
We are still in the grip of COVID-19 and in the cold confines of a lockdown, and we know that it's hard to look beyond the present, but there will definitely be a post-coronavirus world, and it is taking shape right now, presenting us with critical choices. Do we go back to what we had as best that we can? Or do we seize the opportunity to shape a new and more inclusive society and a more sustainable and equitable world? Welcome to Beyond Corona, South Africa and the world after the pandemic. This is brought to you by Kaya FM in association with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. In this episode, we are going to be focusing on a very topical and a critical issue in South Africa for a long time, and this is the issue of xenophobia and migration. And we'll really be talking about what it means in the context of where we've been, what it means in the context of where we are with the pandemic, and of course, what might happen next. So I've got two guests who are obviously very well versed in talking about matters of this nature, and this is Bishop Foster and Dr. Paul Karikin. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good day. Good day to you.
Now, Bishop, I'd like to start with you. We do know that historically South Africa has had a terrible history with instances of xenophobia, for example, having flared up not too long ago. And I suspect a lot of your people are going to say that the type of issues that led to that initial outbreak are probably the type of the issues that we haven't fixed as a country. There are issues that are persistent in nature, and there are issues that are very systemic. And I suspect that this particular pandemic can only worsen those existing fracture points. Just take us back to when we were in 2008, for example, when we really saw the first real big outbreak of xenophobic violence in South Africa. What were the big trigger points back then?
Yeah, I think, good morning. Yes, yeah, the main triggers, again, were, competition over limited resources, and I think that was because you have poor people, in a sense, at the bottom end. You suddenly see people moving into their spaces where they usually make some kind of income in terms of survival economics. And so when that happens, there's competition. And also it's then compounded if it's somebody from another country, and also a country that you don't fully understand, you don't understand the language, etc. So then there's a reaction. And that broadly would be some of the causes, is the socioeconomic sort of causes for it. Then it's exacerbated by people playing into the sort of ethnic identities of everybody. For instance, we never had crime in this area, and crime has only come since certain African groups have come into our area. So there's the stereotypes, and so then the people get angry because people, in a sense, are not seeing that they're beginning to see that the delivery that was made for them, they begin to perceive, is now beginning to, the resources are now beginning to go elsewhere to the African sort of compatriots, as it were. And so broadly speaking, that would be something of the causes, as it were, because You have people from other countries who work in other economic spaces, but you don't have the same reaction because there's not the high competition over limited resources. So I would say that that's one of the key triggers to a lot of the xenophobic attacks, as it were. Then it's translated into actually stereotyping people and saying and blaming it on the foreigners. They're the ones who are taking away the jobs. They're the ones who are causing all the crime. They're the ones that, et cetera, as it were. Yeah.
Thank you, Bishop. Dr. Paul, I mean, some of the things that the Bishop mentions are things that some of us might know are probably inaccurate. So people simply saying that the foreigners are to blame for everything that's going wrong. Surely the role of education and really enabling people to understand what really the dynamics are could be the type of thing or the type of intervention that would assist. Is this something that has happened? Have we learned anything from 2008, or do we still simply let people fester with their own misconceptions about really the role of foreigners and perhaps what the allocation of resources is? Or do we see perhaps there's been a better education around these issues for people on the ground?
Well, I think it's an ongoing work. We understand from the episode that happened in 2008, even as Bishop has correctly pointed out, is that the issue of resources always at the center of xenophobic attacks or xenophobic conflict. And I think for us to see a sustainable change in terms of the way the relationship between African migrants particularly and South African hosts, it'll be a continuous work around, firstly, information to influence the mindset change, and secondly, to continue conscientizing each other the importance of observing human rights, and especially in this case, protection of people's livelihoods, because that's what it always boils down to. So I think work has been done since 2008 by different agencies, civil society, Chapter 9 institutions, and other agencies that are involved in this kind of work. However, the work cannot stop. It has to continue because the triggers are always there. The triggers are, number one, competition for resources, and number two, the challenges of difficulties of making a living every day. And the challenge that creates these sort of attacks abruptly is when these tensions are taken up from a political point of view to make look like it is the African migrants that are really causing the problem. And there could be elements of criminality here and there, but that's not the bigger picture. The bigger picture is there that when there is skewed development that does not meet the aspirations of ordinary citizens right in their own local communities, African migrants often become the easiest target because they seemingly, in the eyes of their hosts in the communities, seem to be earning a living and seem to be doing something that brings them income, while majority of their surrounding neighbors in their communities where they operate their businesses, in this case, seem to be not be making headway economically. So the idea of conscientization and education is important, so that also there is, there is on one part understanding the reasons why migration does happen in the broader scheme of things, and number two, the reason why African migrants are in those communities, and on the African migrants part of it is to start even contemplating ideas like transference of skills. They come into this country with a broad range of skills, entrepreneurial and professional. And there is a way, a mechanism should be created where there is an exchange of skills so that members of communities do not see them as depleters, if I may use that word sparingly, of their resources in their own communities, but also partners in their own local economic development of their own community. But there should be an exchange of skills so that it becomes part of harmonizing relationships towards peace building and peace sustenance.
Yeah, and I think, Dr. Paul, you raised some very important points, though, but I think one element of this that I'd like to explore a bit further is that we know we say that African migrants become the target, but one then has to question if the issue is really foreigners in general are crowding us out and taking our jobs, at least from the perspective of some people. Why would then it have an acute impact when those foreigners are black, rather than saying that we have a position or we have issues against foreigners at large? And my suspicion is that perhaps most of these tension points happen to occur at what you might call the lower end of the economic spectrum or the lower end of the economic ladder, where, of course, it just turns out that a lot of the migrants, whether they're African or from other parts of the world, they do try to seek opportunity. They happen to be black. I mean, I've never heard of a white migrant who is being allocated a job in a high-rise building in Sandton, for example, being subjected to these types of issues. Is there still a lot of us to explore around how people perceive migrants versus black migrants?
That's a very interesting trajectory. And again, we cannot hide our heads in the sand like the proverbial ostrich and assume that these things do not exist. We have seen that whenever there is a flare up of any xenophobic attacks, it's usually against African black migrants. And correctly, as you pointed, we've never seen other migrants from other, outside of the continent being targeted. So there is definitely a serious issue around Afrophobia around there. And that also is a dimension that needs to be explored further and be, you know, be addressed. And really one of the issues, again, as I said, that the resentment is always about resources. And the feeling of others, African who look like us, seem to be doing well in the same situation we are in.
We still have a lot in order to learn about just perhaps xenophobia in general and the distinction between xenophobia and Afrophobia, because I think there is definitely a lot of evidence that indicates that most of these xenophobic attacks tend to be targeted towards black migrants and black foreigners. And of course, there's no reason to believe that only black migrants and black foreigners ever end up in South Africa. There are migrants and foreigners of all persuasions and of all racial and ethnicities. And yet, when we speak about xenophobia, the pictures that we see and the evidence that we see seems to be what you may refer to as targeted on black migrants and indeed people from foreign lands. What's your view on that?
I think the racial dimension of xenophobic attacks becomes more real when there is insufficient knowledge and understanding why migration in the first place takes place, and number two, why are migrants in the country in the second place. And I think until that is well communicated across the public in a way that does distinguish between the reasons for why people migrate, because migration is a global phenomenon and it didn't start yesterday. It will continue. People will always be moving from one place to another, from one country to another. But there has to be an understanding, why do people move? And then secondly, trying to address the real core of the issue. The core of the issue here is competition for resources, access to economic opportunities. And what really creates the resentment that ultimately results into violence is the fact that some African migrants come in with already skills that they are able to explore opportunities to make a living, make a livelihood. They don't wait back. The conditions that they find themselves in do not allow them to sit back and wait for things to be delivered into their hands. So that ability to exercise some entrepreneurial agency on their part becomes a core issue of straining relationships between them and their South African hosts in whichever communities they find themselves in. So I think there's a lot of education needs to be done here in massive public education, selecting the third place. And secondly, how can we mitigate the issue of exchange transfer of skills between African migrants and their local South African hosts? And this is where there is a multi-pronged approach that needs to be implemented. So it's civil society collaborating with department, government of departments that are relevant to this work versus Chapter 9 institutions versus organized migrant formations, and at the same time also organized community-based local economic development committees or structures where majority of migrant African migrants do conduct their business operations. This is very important if the issue of xenophobia and Afrophobic tendencies that always tend to become violent will be addressed to a place where there is peaceful existence between the two groups. And of course, then address a bigger issue around why is xenophobic attacks always targeted towards African migrants but not members of other race groups from the outside of the continent. Then there must be an issue going on there that needs to be debunked. And I think we have not gotten to a place of having that courageous conversation among us itself as a society, but also among the two migrant communities. Why is it that it's often targeted towards African migrant business entrepreneurs? That conversation needs to be happening, and it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, definitely. Afropolitans, we are discussing Beyond Corona, South Africa and the World After the Pandemic. This is a podcast brought to you by KSM in association with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. And the focus of our conversation today is on xenophobia and migration. I'm speaking to Bishop Foster and Dr. Paul Kariukin, who are giving us some insights. And so far, we've been looking particularly at the issue of the historical context of xenophobia in South Africa. And I think the Bishop and Dr. Paul do highlight that, you know, at the end, it's probably more about a competition of resources. And we know that when scarcity is the reality, then the type of competition does have very, very high tension points. Bishop, I mean, Dr. Paul Kariuki here talks about this particular utopia where we can perhaps get everybody across the table to understand where they come from, to understand what resources each group has, and to understand that how a transfer of resource can be done. But I suspect that we live in a country where there are so many other competing priorities for our politicians in particular, a conversation of that nature is not something that is going to emerge organically from the political leadership. It probably needs or requires a very different take or a different approach. What is it that we can put together to actually say, let us bypass the politicians, if I may put it like that, and say, let us do things in a way that actually deals with the issue that is so well understood. We can discuss it 12 years later, but also acknowledge that it might happen simply because not much has been done to fix it.
Yes, yeah, sure. I mean, just to remind us that there was a major outbreak in 2015. And I remember that those of us who were involved in the 2015 outbreak of xenophobic violence, we reflected on the 2008 outbreak and said, what often happens is that people respond emotionally to a crisis. And then you get all sorts of groups that are set up, and they only last for a few months there afterwards, and they fizzle out once the sort of main climax of the violence dies down. But the issues don't go. In 2015, we said, no, we've got to continue regardless. You know, even if it feels as though there's no violence, it's still got to continue because the underlying causes have not been addressed. So you might recall that the Premier at the time commissioned a special reference group on migration and community integration in KwaZulu-Natal, and they produced a very comprehensive study of the causes of violence and also some of the suggested ways forward. And one of the major suggested ways forward was obviously to address the economic issue, but also the improvement of better understanding between our African compatriots and our local folk, because many of us South Africans, because of the isolation years, we were cut off from the rest of Africa. And so we don't fully understand what some of the historical impacts of violence has been in different countries, like the DRC, for instance, where, you know, from about 97, they had two major wars, and there were like 5 million people that lost their lives. And there are many of our people who don't actually even know that. And we've had some groups where we sat down with some local folk and some folk from other parts of Africa, and when they began to speak about their experiences and histories, both those in KwaZulu-Natal who went through a hectic, violent time during the 80s and 90s, they shared their experiences. And then those from the DRC and other parts of Africa said, these are our experiences. It totally transformed the thinking and understanding of one another. So I think it's a very important component that we have to have these courageous conversations. But I think you rightly say that there seems to be a lack of political will to do this. And there's a myriad of reasons for that. And so often we found that local councillors, upcoming elections, and they kind of read the emotions of their people, and then they begin to say, well, as you rightfully said, you know, foreign nationals are not a priority, my people are a priority, and that creates the sort of some of the real challenges that we have. So I really think that as South Africans, we need a total re-education of our understanding of African history. We don't really understand Africa because of the isolation years during apartheid. And so I also think that that's a very, very key factor, the issue of education. And then also, how do we deal with the socioeconomic justice for all, as it were? And that's an ongoing thing. I mean, just yesterday I was in one of the informal settlements. And again, the same informal settlement was there in the 1980s, and nothing has changed. So, you know, our politicians aren't even doing things for our local people. And so we need to to work together on this, I think. And we need to sit down and, as you say, have courageous conversations with practical outcomes. But this particular report and the study that was done by an independent group at the time, they pointed out to ways ahead. And then immediately after that, the politicians had plans in place. They had the functionaries to carry it out, and it fizzled out. And that's what happened. We have so many reports. We have analyzed this. All we need to do is we need to implement it. There's a bishop friend of mine who always says, we know what to do. We now need to do what we know. You see, and that for me is the thing. We don't need any further analysis. We know the problem. We now need to implement what some of the solutions are.
Yeah. Thank you, Bishop. Dr. Paul, I mean, the Bishop refers to the political will being perhaps the one missing ingredient. But I'd like to explore that further, because my suspicion is that even if the political will might exist, you might find that the political capacity isn't there. We know that historically the former Johannesburg mayor always complained about what he said was a scourge of illegal immigration within the country. There are other parts of the healthcare system that have also complained about similar issues. And it looks like in some instances, the best intentions notwithstanding, if the government then had to go and say, we are fixing this, they wouldn't know where to start. So a lot of people would say in the townships, suddenly there's far too many foreign-owned shops. But of course, the concept of it going foreign-owned is simply based on me looking at the person behind the till and saying, they don't sound like me, they don't look like me, so therefore it must be a foreign-owned shop. And in the absence of, you know, data from the state to actually legitimize or discredit their theory, these are the types of narratives that fester out there. Do we have a problem of political will or political capacity?
I agree. There is a problem with political will. But however, again, it becomes a very loaded term when it's convoluted with a complex issue like migration and xenophobia in this instance, because there's different competing interests from either side of the conversation. Politicians generally have their own interest in managing processes like this, and therefore they are always very suspicious of ramifications that may ensue out of their response to a complex situation like this. The issue of political risk for them, it becomes significant. What if the public, for example, sees them supporting the idea of migrant entrepreneurship in the face of growing unemployment, for instance? So the decision that they would arrive at will be informed by those competing political interests. What do they want to communicate to the public in the face of a pandemic, in the face of job losses, in the face of high levels of unemployment, in the face of shrinking economy? Definitely, it's not a conversation that will be in favor of supporting skills, for example, skills differentiation, skills transfer between migrants and their South African hosts in their own communities. So for me, the big issue is that whilst there may be implicit political will to make things work and ensure there is peaceful coexistence so that the economy in general in the country can function, because it cannot be well with the economy nationally if there is political instability. So the bigger issue is they want to maintain political stability so that it's investor-friendly for the country, but also at the same time manage political risk at the grassroots level, where decision-making is very, very important, because they need to make sure that there is no political backlash. And in a country like this where electoral cycles are very, very close to each other, the in-between space between the last election and the next one becomes a very tricky space, because majority of that point of time between the last elections and the next one, there is a divergence of focus from the electoral promises to other competing issues of national interest. Then these issues of electorate supporting political parties always comes sometimes just very close to the elections, sometimes 12 to 18 months to the elections. And that is always the tricky time when we see potential flare-ups of xenophobic tensions. And now the political risk at that time is to say, are they going to maintain peace in the face of electoral promises that were not fulfilled? Or are they going to support a process of peace and encourage coexistence so that there is stability to make sure that elections take place freely and fair, and at the same time not lose their political bloc? So the political risk becomes the big driver of what might happen that can create a political backlash at the local level. So for me, I see a tension between a national will in the case of managing political stability nationally versus a competing risk or risks, competing interests at the local level to manage and mitigate against any political backlash that may look for party A or party B to look as if it's not interested in the well-being and the welfare of the local hosts. That, for me, is the tension that needs to be managed.
Yeah, those are important insights, Dr. Paul, because, I mean, even yesterday we were reflecting on the fact that last year we had the general election, and we're already looking forward to the next cycle of the local government election. So perhaps because our electoral cycle is so compressed, there isn't much time to engage on substantive issues before the politics creeps into it and, of course, alter the direction of the discourse. So I think that's a very important point that you're raising here. Bishop, I want to put something to you that is perhaps something a lot of people don't still struggle to distinguish between. So a few weeks ago, there was a court judgment that said that the COVID relief fund that the government has put together must also be extended to refugees. And of course, for a lot of South Africans, there was a hysteria of saying, wait a minute, I am a South African, I'm still waiting, I haven't received a response about my application, and yet here's a court directing that the government should take limited resources and give it to a person who's still not a full citizen of the country. And my fear is that there is still a huge level of education that needs to be done on getting people to understand the distinction between refugees, between legal migrants, and the illegal immigration problem that people like Hemant Mashab have spoken about. But of course, the problem and the consequence is that in the absence of forcing everybody to hold a piece of paper wherever they turn, for a layman, if a person doesn't look like them, doesn't sound like them, they can simply just put them into one bucket. You're a foreigner. You must be illegal until you prove otherwise. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, it's a good point there, because I think we need to be reminded that many South Africans were refugees in other countries and they were kept in camps. And I know that one of the gracious policies, and we need to acknowledge that, of the South African government was to say that we don't want to put refugees in camps. We want to integrate them into our communities and society, and we want them to have the same protection under the Constitution. And we were welcoming our African brothers and sisters, as it were. And I think that when you speak to local people, I think the one part that we missed out on was to actually properly introduce people in communities. You know, for instance, I remember in the Manguzi area being involved in when we had a worker from Mozambique, and just to use the sort of church terminology, we had an evangelist from Mozambique. The first thing we did was introduce him to the local Amakosi. And then everybody knew who he was, you know. So there was something of that process that probably was needed. And I think a lot of people acknowledged that. So that
social integration component.
The integration component wasn't done very well. You know, people just arrived thinking that, yes, we'll be welcomed by South Africans. And South Africans are saying, hey, who are these people? They're standing on my doorstep, you know. So I think that wasn't done very well, as it were. And so, you know, today, that's why we're almost catching up now to try and create better relationships. So that's part of the background to this. So the perception is that there's not enough resources for everybody in terms of social grants. There is. Is enough for everybody. It's just the mechanisms of the technical mechanism that is often holdups, where people, where things are delayed, or there's not information given, etc. So the obvious perception that if I haven't received my social grant, and I discover that a foreign national has, it may not be because it's favoring the foreign national. It's really because there might be a technical problem, you know, as it were. So I think the issue around education, but I think just to add to this, that the most vulnerable people at the moment, the refugees are in the system. And they are often discriminated. They would say they're discriminated by different groups like Home Affairs, et cetera. That's the allegations often. But the most vulnerable at the moment, especially under COVID, that we've discovered are the economic migrants, where in a way they're not part of any system. And some of them are undocumented, obviously, and so on. But they come here and suddenly they receive nothing. They're not in any system. And so obviously through groups like the churches, et cetera, we've discovered these groups and have wanted to offer, you know, at least some kind of safety net of passing. But one thing we've been very clear about is that if we get a list of names from any particular area, we make sure that everybody's included. That we don't just give to people who are so-called foreign nationals, but we give to everybody in that community. And there's always that danger that even in our responses, that we end up exacerbating the problem by saying, okay, we see the problem with the foreign nationals, so therefore let's give them free parcels, and then the neighbors see that, and then it creates its problem. So we say to any community leader within the foreign national communities, make a list of everybody in your area so everybody can receive the same kind of a relief, especially during COVID-19. So that is something of what I think needs to be addressed. It really is about the integration, you know, and I think, yeah, sure.
Dr. Paul, I think one of the big fears that some of us have is really on, I think, even the economic migrants that the bishop just mentioned. These are individuals who exist but don't exist. And when I say they exist but don't exist, we know that they are here. We know that they are amongst us, but they're not documented in the system. And for me, during this particular pandemic, I think one of the great anxieties is that if a person is a person who's here, but their paper not in order, for example, this is a person who's not going to ordinarily approach institutions or agencies of state to say, I need assistance with this. But of course, when we're dealing with a pandemic, everybody who has the type of symptoms that warrant a healthcare intervention should be able to go and get that healthcare intervention. But my worry is that far too many people are going to then say, if I do show up then and they ask for this and that and I don't have it, I'm now being exposed to being a person who might be deported back to a place where perhaps, you know, the living conditions are not ideal. I'm a person who may even end up being arrested. But I think the consequences of people in that particular, space not being able to access healthcare services may just have much bigger implications for the healthcare system at large when you're trying to manage this pandemic.
You're correct. Yes, and that's very true. That's one of the difficulties of managing migration in the country at such a time as this. Because now it moves from from just a policy issue to a humanitarian one, where now is the interest of the persons in front of you that needs to be taken care of. And sometimes it becomes very difficult for migrants themselves who know they do not have the right papers to be in the country to be able to even be bold enough to approach the state for support. So they rely on their own networks. And when they run out of options, then it becomes an issue that gets now the attention of the world through humanitarian crisis. Having said that, I think one of the difficulties that also the government may be experiencing in trying to manage this situation to make sure that there is, on one hand, extending human rights, providing the essential services that need to be accessed by everyone who is on the land in the country, versus managing a challenge of irregular migration, where people come into the country, do not take opportunities to introduce themselves to the state in the sense to be documented, in the sense that they are legally in the country. It becomes a challenge, and it cannot be solved by either government alone or migrants alone. There has to be a way of regularizing migration management, in the sense that it makes it easier for migrants who are coming into the country, even though they come in legally, they find a way of getting themselves documented. There has been a lot of reports written over the last 3 or so years since the last xenophobic attack in 2016 about the challenges of migrants even getting their own papers to be, from the Department of Home Affairs. And I'm sure that that challenge is still persisting, especially now that there is there is a decentralized system where they can go to different centers in the different metros or cities across the country, but still the process of getting themselves documented is still a challenge for most. And so some, because of the onerous responsibility of that process, they give up in between and decide to stay undocumented. While it may look good in the short term, in the medium term, in the long term, it becomes a problem for them, the migrants. And then when a pandemic like this comes into play, it complicates the picture because the state can only respond to those they know are in the country legally. The illegal migrants, then it becomes very difficult for them to access support. And then it becomes a problem now. Of course, we've seen they try to get avenues of making that plight visible to everybody. And sometimes it comes across as if the government is not playing its part, but it's actually probably is doing by the systemic challenges that make it difficult for irregular migrants to get themselves documented. So I think for me, it's again another conversation that needs to happen between the government and migrants, organized groups that frontier the plight of the migrants, so that they can be able to communicate this message across through the proper channels of those networks that can reach the migrants at the local level, but at the same time address the systemic challenges with the Department of Home Affairs so that it can become easier and less onerous for migrants to be documented.
Bishop Foster, I'm going to take a bit of a quantum leap on the basis of what Dr. Paul just said and say, I hear perhaps there is a case for an amnesty process, and that amnesty process is the one that says, never mind what's happened in the past, if the people are sham and we need to manage the pandemic, it will be self-defeating for us to pretend that they don't exist. So perhaps an approach that says, whoever you are, wherever you've been, however you ended up sham, if you need help, come through, no questions asked. Is that the type of amnesty situation that probably is a legitimate response in terms of a pandemic? And I think also as a follow-up, after that, I think for me, the reality is that it is pointless to pretend that these instances of people who are here without the right documentation do not exist. They do exist, and pretending that they don't may actually end up with a much bigger spike in the pandemic itself, which is going to be self-defeating. What's your view on that?
Wow, Kaya, I think that's using imagination in the right way. I think that that's the kind of imagining that we need, and graciousness in terms of saying, yes, let's have an amnesty. We're in a very, very difficult situation, COVID-19. And not only is it in the interests of the migrants, but it's also in the interests of every South African that people, in a sense, are cared for and so on. Yeah. So I really think that, floating that idea sounds very good. And, perhaps we need to take it even further. And sorry, you remind me of your second question again?
I was saying that the reason for me thinking amnesty may be the way to go is that it's pointless for us to pretend that these instances don't exist when the consequence might be 10 or 15 or 20 infected people simply going to stay out of the healthcare system and end up infecting others on the basis that there's a fear that when they do approach the system, they'll be deported and, discovered.
Yes, and I think perhaps that was my point about it, in our own self-interest that people are brought out as well. So, I mean, most people operate out of self-interest. And so if you say to them it's in your interest that we service and we don't prosecute or send people or put them in detention camps, whatever the case may be, but that we actually care for them as any other South African or any other human being, as it were. I mean, it is very controversial. There's all sorts of things that, given the attitudes of people that just want to tighten the borders and everybody wants illegal immigrants out. I mean, that's the kind of rhetoric and political posturing of many, many groups at the moment to try and and win favor, political favor, with certain groups of people, as it were. But I think that that is really the kind of imagination that we need to be using at the moment, is to think of what is the most just, what is the most compassionate and way of dealing with everybody in South Africa, including those who are undocumented migrants, as it were. And I know that might sound naive, and you know, there's all sorts of complications around that, but at the end of the day, a lot of these economic migrants are fleeing situations, and that's another issue we have to address, is why are people fleeing from their situations? And we need to be addressing the broader injustices that are happening in other parts of Africa that are causing this influx. I mean, we have a huge problem that's going to break out in Mozambique quite soon. Already, you know, internally displaced people because of the movement of what is allegedly ISIS groups that are coming into northern Mozambique and so on. And we may even have another influx of refugees from Mozambique, you know, if we don't pay attention to those things. So I think that, you know, we cannot have this discussion without talking about the whole of Africa and the broader questions around why is it that Africa, in a sense, is so wealthy, and yet the people are so poor. You know, those are very key questions. And why do people feel that they are forced to leave their lands and their particular countries to come to places where they think it's better? But when they arrive in South Africa, they realize it's not as great as they thought it was going to be. But some of them even say that even under these conditions, it's even better than being at home. So what is home like, you know, as it were? So these are really key questions that we have to open up and have some very, very courageous conversations about. And it has to be within the broader African context that we have these conversations.
Yeah. Dr. Paul Kariuki, I mean, the concept of an amnesty, for me personally, there is a particular upside to this. And when I talk about the upside, is that the previous Minister of Health, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi in particular, was always at pains to remind us that the problem with illegal immigration, for example, is that he couldn't possibly predict the resources that were needed in one province versus the next if he didn't know who was them and the type of, you know, infection or diseases that they might have. And I suspect that in this particular instance, again, the government has to deal with the fact that we do have citizens that are undocumented that have fallen between the cracks. And I think that a system of amnesty, for example, will then be at least able to deal with the healthcare question of do we know who's here, do we know what the burden of disease is, so that we can distribute resources in a manner that responds to where the spikes might be. And for me, that is probably the one real upside of a possible amnesty conversation. What's your view on that?
I agree with you 100% that there is need for us to show compassion and in the sense to show our extent of humanity. And I think the action by the former Minister of Health at the time, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, was really very, very, very encouraging sentiment from coming from the high level of the government in showing compassion towards migrants in that way, that they can still access healthcare, for example, and be able to, you know, be treated even though they may not be here legally. And of course, with the recognition of the strain that it puts on the existing resources, because everything needs to be accounted for. Having said that, I think the idea of amnesty should be encouraged in the sense also that it accounts on the current realities, economic realities, and the fragility that has come across due to the economic strain on the government side, but also at the same time also a conversation with the broader society that in a time of strangeness like this pandemic really is about our compassion and humanity. I remember at some stage a few months ago when just we were entering the lockdown, the first level of lockdown, and the EFF leader, Mr. Malema, did mention that it's important for government when it's distributing food purses to consider migrants also leading the communities where the food purses are being distributed. And he got a flag from the different quarters because the sentiment of compassion had not come in at that level. yeah, and it was still being seen as a narrative that is us versus them, and why should the government even pay attention to migrants when we are actually facing, you know, starvation? But it's these kind of things, that the kind of narratives that we need to be conversing as much as possible and often as possible, because there is a real side of humanity to all these complexities, and no one can exist on their own. So I think it's important to bring in an amnesty conversation in managing and mitigating the different conditions. And of course, it's not a blanket amnesty. It's for a season. It's a period to allow, you know, for us to reach out to others in the sense of making sure that they also leave. And of course, whilst that is all being done, it is not happen. It's not a conversation that is happening in isolation. It's a policy conversation to begin with, because then the resources have to be found elsewhere, to be reallocated to meet that kind of a need. And I think that's where the tension can be in terms of the bigger, broader intervention scheme of government. Where do they begin? How do they even begin? Where do they get the resources? How do they manage the political backlash? And, you know, and all those kind of things. So it's a policy conversation that needs to happen, but at the same time driven by compassion. And I really must say that the majority of South African hosts have been very, very kind to most of the majority of migrants in their own communities. Look, there's nobody who is isolated from challenges. It could be one time it's African migrants. It could be next time it could be somebody else in another country. And, you know, the acts of compassion go a long way to promote social justice. And even in a way, they heal the rifts between migrants and their hosts in their own communities, because challenges of this nature do not choose a race, do not choose a nationality, do not choose an ethnic tribe. They face us, and they face all of us from a humanitarian point of view. And so therefore, the idea of amnesty then comes in from that point of view, and needs to be managed from a policy issue, policy angle, and from a political angle with different stakeholders to make it work.
Thank you, Dr. Paul Kariuki. Bishop Foster, last word for you. If you had the ability to influence policy tomorrow or the day after, and this policy would be the country's national response, our pandemic influence response to the xenophobia and migration issues, what would be the key points of that policy?
I think it's twofold. The one is addressing the economic issue, to kind of improve. You know, it's interesting that the promotion of local chambers of business. In other words, bringing together all the local spaza shops and foreign national shops, and they form their own different associations. I think that for me should be a priority, so that they work together in an area. You know, that's the one thing. The second thing for me is that we need to introduce huge education policies of within schools, within universities, whatever else, that it's almost compulsory that we have a education system on the history of Africa and the great civilizations of Africa, and also the recent history of Africa in terms of the conflicts within the broader global context of exploitation, so that people can begin to understand why migration happens. And I think that really would go a long way in addressing some of these key issues. So the first is the economic one of being very practical in bringing local micro enterprises together, and the second is the broader issue of conscientizing and raising awareness of through historical education of who we are on this continent as South Africans.
Thank you very much, Bishop Foster, and also Dr. Paul Kariukim, Apopolitan. This has been a conversation on Beyond Corona, South Africa and the World After the Pandemic. It is brought to you in association with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. And, of course, these conversations will be going on until we at least find a way to deal with the world as it will be after we survive this particular pandemic. Thank you very much to my guest, and also special thanks to the Konrad Adenauer Foundation for sponsoring this podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by Kaya FM in partnership with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation.